Welcome to the Beekeeper's Corner Podcast. October 12, 2025, episode 284, out and about. Hello, everyone. Welcome into the corner, the Beekeeper's Corner. I'm Kevin England. Driving to work this week, I noticed the leaves are starting to change in our zone, and leaf peeping time is upon us. My brain connects the change of color for the leaves to ensuring that 2-2-1 feed is going on with the bees. And that, Kevin, time is running out. If you don't feed your bees now, they won't be fat and happy. And incidentally, usually you feed 1-1 in the spring to keep the colony going, and 2-1 in the fall for storage. That's the beekeeping moment that wandered through my brain as I was driving out through Asbury on the way to work this week. It's been a busy stretch lately with the remodeling project on the house, and as you'll hear in a little bit, my part-time job that sometimes becomes a full-time job when the need arises. As such, it's been a little bit difficult to find time to record, but today I put my nose to the grindstone and, well, this is an episode to share with you that I have, which unloads my brain, all the things that are floating around in there. We're going to talk about a great discovery in the field alongside our property. That's roundtable number one. Roundtable number two, the utility and ingenuity of beehive lifters. Roundtable number three, one step forward, two steps back. Finding mistake in retrospect and reflecting on what I should have done and sharing some insight about how to paint beehive equipment that's already been painted. So hopefully we'll keep you away from making the mistake that I did. Roundtable number four, it's been a stretch since Bob Kloss has been on the show. Wanted to share a quick update that he's on the mend and ask you to send some healing thoughts to him during his recovery from a recent heart procedure. Roundtable number five, there's a window of activities coming up this week that starts a few sessions where I'll be out and about, and I'll talk about the joy of being a participant in collaborating with other beekeepers. Local hive report, it's been a while since I've talked about what's going on in the apiary, and I'll give you a quick update on some things I discovered as I went through a few hives this weekend. And as usual, I'll close the show with a couple odds and ends. I'm all business today, so kevin@bkcorner.org is my email if you want to write in. The website, www.bkcorner.org. And if you would be so kind, like and subscribe to the podcast in the player, that would really help us out, especially if you leave a comment. Let's say we get this party started. Roundtable number one, clover's in the yard. I'm looking over a four-leaf clover that I overlooked before. About this time last year, Sharon and I went and took a class on how to harvest syrup from sugar maples to make homemade maple syrup. This past spring, we tapped a small number of trees on our property and made a modest amount of maple syrup. And when I say modest, I mean more like it was a little bit more than a cup and less than a quart. If you know anything about making maple syrup, you have to get a tremendous amount of the liquid out of the trees and then boil it down to the point where it becomes maple syrup that you know. As someone who grasps what it takes to make honey, that gives me a profound appreciation to say that our practices have little on the amount of effort and respect that goes into what our peers in the maple syrup industry must do in order to make what we see on, say, the Costco shelves and jugs, let alone all the syrup you see in the stores. You can understand why a lot of it is corn syrup, but the actual true stuff, what a craft. Now to the point of this roundtable. This morning, Sharon and I donned some knee-high boots and went walking around the property looking at all the trees. Now, we know that there are some sugar maples right out behind the house. But this is the time of year when the leaves turn that it's easy to see because sugar maples, the leaves turn yellow and they have a specific pattern to them and they're easier to spot. We wanted to walk along the yard into the front of the property to see if we could locate any other sugar maple trees that we weren't aware of. Something to tap to add to the collection of the couple that we were working. As to the endeavor, we found one or two more trees that we could potentially look at in the backyard. But what I want to talk about is the discovery in the field next door as we wandered around. In this day of having your phone in your hand at all times, there are two practices that Sharon and I partake in frequently that have been a really fun pastime and something you could hardly do with the speed and agility in today's age if you have a phone in your hand. It's amazing. The first one is the use of the Merlin app, which identifies in real time what birds you are hearing in your ecosystem. You know, there's times when we take a break from whatever we're doing and we sit in the backyard and we might, setting the app to listen, register 10, 15 birds within a 20-minute span. It's neat to see the birds that you didn't even know were there. Like sometimes you see Baltimore Orioles and things like that you generally don't see. But when you hear them, you can then look and find them. This particular app is magical in that it can identify what you're listening to, even if the sound is really far off. It has the ability to pick it out and tell you it's a house wren or it's a red-tailed hawk or a blue jay or some other bird. Finds all the common ones and all the esoteric ones. The name of that app, if you missed it, is Merlin, M-E-R-L-I-N. And if you don't have it on your phone, you should go get it quickly because it is a fun thing to do. No matter where you are, you're going to be able to hear the birds. Now, I said two apps. The second app and or feature is one that you can get called iNaturalist, or it's a feature built into your iPhone. I don't own an Android. And the way this one works is you take a photograph of a plant, and on the iPhone, if you swipe up, most of the time, doesn't work all the time, it will do a cross-reference and tell you what the plant is. And iNaturalist, you take a picture and it will cross-reference and do the same thing. As we wandered around the property this morning, I took a photo of some berries on a bush. And when I scrolled up on my iPhone, it told me that it is wild privet. And from there, you could pop over to your search engine and say, do bees visit wild privet? And the answer is yes. Bees visit it during the summer for nectars. And birds visit in the stage right now when it has the tiny little berries. They look like blueberries, but mind you, the birds can eat them, but alas, we cannot. They are poisonous to us. So we walked over to the side of the property, over where the old apiary was, over by the satellite hive, and went into the field to walk along the side yard to get to the property. That was easier than walking through our woods and through the underbrush and the stickers and the briars and the brambles. As we walked along the field, I looked down and saw another plant that I wasn't familiar with. Kevin moment. Not familiar with. Coupled with plants. It's something I could say with all certainty that you'll hear me say it often. I am just terrible about identifying plants. You know, even if I've looked them up in the past, there's no brain storage area in my brain that holds on to that. I just don't retain it. I could turn to Sharon and say, what is this thing? And she would say, oh, it's a blah, 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 blah. And I'd say, oh, okay. But the next time I see that plant, I'm going to say, Sharon, what is this thing? Just saying. End of Kevin moment. So it turns out that the plant I was staring at is something referred to as smartweed. And I don't recall the particular genus. It told me it was a something smart weed. But when I looked it up, bees also work that too. And it was all over the ground cover of the field next door. Now, mind you, this is the neighbor's field, which is about, 4 acres or so. And the entire ground at this time of year would have been covered with goldenrod had he not come and cut it all down just a few weeks ago, right when the goldenrod was going to bloom. I know that because in the margins where he didn't mow, close up to the tree line next to our property, there's goldenrod all along the edge of the field. And it's such a lost opportunity. It makes me sad and cry, but so it goes. Now, I don't particularly know the person other than in passing who owns that property. There's no house there. I know he lives in the neighborhood. I know which house is his down the road from us. And he just shows up every fall to mow the field, to keep the trees from growing in it. And I think someday, somewhere along the line, he intends to put a home there. But for now, he just mows the field periodically through the season. Last year, actually, I was able to head him off. I walked out and physically stood in front of his mower while he was mowing and asked him to stop and told him it would be amazing if you let the goldenrod grow and could you come back in a couple weeks. And to my surprise, he's like, oh yeah, sure. I didn't really want to mow the grass today anyway, but I had nothing to do. I think I told this story on the show. Anyway, we walked along the field and got to the far end, and Sharon reminded me I had the apiary on one end along our side of our property and on the other end down by the road. Sharon reminded me that when this field was owned by our other neighbor, Jill, up the hill, if you remember me mentioning it from a previous episode, they owned the field and sold it off. She had given me permission to plant some clover, a little patch right next to where I kept my bees up on the front of the property. I bought, back then, a bag of seed one year and went up, scratched the ground in a pretty large swath. It was large for the amount of work. I want to say about 15 feet by 80 foot long. And back then, I'm going to say this was about 6 years ago. It was such a modest little square of planting compared to the large size of the field. But, you know, I didn't give it a second thought after it was done. And the next year, it didn't look that impressive. And then the year after that, they sold the property to the person who owns it now. And I moved the bees out of there, so didn't think much about it. We wandered over to the edge of the property of the field to see, by happenstance, if there was any evidence, after Sharon's reminder, of clover that I planted in that swath. And at first there wasn't anything, and I know where I planted it. At the edge of the field there's a small stand of trees, and then for whatever reason the previous farmer went beyond those trees and cut a path. I think he used it to ride around the outside of the field, and that's where I planted the clover. We walked into that path and there wasn't any clover. And then, there was a small spot, about the size of a car, I want to say, there. And it was clearly the clover that I planted. And I thought, how cool is that? Sharon was over looking at something else. And it was an exciting moment to see the clover had persisted. And I took the victory as a sentimental thought that it actually worked out, because the year after, I didn't see anything. I walked around the handful of trees and the path to go back out into the field and looked down at the other part. I had planted both that pathway and right next to the trees. And guess what? There was clover growing there too. At that point, Sharon had joined me, and we both stood there and looked at the field past the spot where we were standing. Well, what did our wandering eyes see? It's a sea of clover. The clover had propagated from that side of the trees out to cover at least a half acre, if not more, from the spot we were standing. When the new people bought the property, the farmer ceased cutting the field up, meaning he used to be in there and plow the field and plant corn and other things. And apparently, because this person is only mowing it, it allows the clover to go to seed each year, and it's spreading across this field from that modest little plot that I planted all those years ago. My mood turned from joy to jubilation in thinking, what a cool thing to discover 6 years ago. Who knew what little footprint I left? Not only did my clover persist, but it's propagating. And I'm sure that as time goes on, our bees are finding this as forage. I think it probably, given the size of it, has quite potential for the bees when they find it. Given how much resource it is, the bees are going to orient to it and come to it in moss. And that would make, of course, any beekeeper happy. Now, not wanting to wear out our welcome of standing in the neighbor's property, we walked down to the front of the road and continued our quest to find at least two more trees that we could tap in the spring to make maple syrup. I'm sure our bees and the neighbor's bees down the road and around the corner are probably all appreciative of this little patch that will hopefully give them some sustenance through the years. I have a cousin whose nickname is Bubby, and she does this really cool thing about Happy Bubby. Well, guess what? I'm a Happy Bubby. Roundtable number 2, Beehive Lifters. In a recent episode, I spoke of the lifting device that is now offered by Flo, the makers of the Flo Hive. In that creepy, is it coincidence or is it the universe listening kind of way, two items popped up for me recently about beehive lifting devices. Kevin moment. I'm not sure, you know, if Big Brother is listening or if I happen to be tuned into the topic and since it serendipitously showed up in one of my social media feeds, I glommed on to the notion that I should look at this thing. But really, it's Big Brother is listening, you know. It happens too frequently to be an accident. Somewhere, somehow, this happenstance collision of topics, is it just coincidental? Or is it something else altogether? Anywho, end of Kevin moment. As I was saying, two items popped up, and while these days I don't know that I need any other gadgets in my garage, I do find the ingenuity interesting, mostly from the engineering standpoint. The first one I wanted to talk about is a levered hive lifter levered that uses leverage to pick up the boxes. The concepts not too novel. Devices like this have been around and conceived for decades. I think about lifters for Waray hives, for example. The device I'm going to describe is what I might call a scissor lift. It's a square tubing bracket sitting over a square tubing bracket with an X-brace that when pivoted with a lever lets you lift in the fashion of a scissor jack. These are common in other industries, motorcycle lifts, snowmobile lifts, lawn tractor lifts, automotive industry for lifting cars and such. In the case of the clip I saw, this device, it has the requirement that you must fasten a rail, a wooden rail on the outside of your box for the lift to engage with. And obviously that rail needs to be really fastened well because it's going to carry the weight of anything that's above it and below it. Now that fact in itself might simply be a non-starter for some, but going with the flow, you put the device on the rail of the box you wish to inspect in your hive stack, and the device slots underneath the bottom side of the rail that's attached to the box above it. standing behind the hive. You swing down the lever to open the scissor, and you'll find the boxes above the inspection box, suspended up over the stack. Now, it doesn't raise it up to the point where you could have to work underneath those boxes and you could pull frames out. This is the second feature of the device. You push the square tubing bracket that's engaged with the top boxes, holding them up above the stack, forward, and they slide out of the way on something that's akin to like a heavy-duty drawer slide. They go out and in front of the hive you want to inspect, and you're free to start plucking frames out of the bottom box. How's this all work? Hard to say. I could see some caution alarms going off in my head. The thing tilts forward because your hive stands on a soft ground. You probably really need to ratchet your boxes together so that they are fastened to the hive stand and such. But the demonstration seemed quite plausible when watching the video, and here's the thing. Some folks who want to keep bees are simply not in a position to lift heavy objects. And this thingamajig lets you move boxes up and out of the way. And to them, it would be irrelevant to what it costs. It means you can spend your hard-earned money to do the thing that you're set out to do, keeping bees. Now the other device, it's a different take and provides a different utility. This device I'm going to talk about is from beehivelifters.com. It's akin to a modified / motorized hand dolly. These two, from a concept, are not novel. I've seen variations of this type of device and idea over the years. But again, these are something you might need in your life for one reason or another based on your situation. The premise here is, in a nutshell, instead of having a built-in blade, 90-degree blade at the bottom of a hand truck, it has two posts that protrude out to engage the honey box by inserting little flip-down levers, I'll call them, that engage in the handholds of your box to lift it when you want to raise the box or lower the box. No rail needed to attach to your equipment. This would work straight out of the gate with whatever kind of Langstroth box you have. Now, as noted, I've seen other variations of this idea, and in the past, some of them use hand cranks to move the boxes up and down, and others use electric motors. The two arms that protrude out from the bottom of the device go up and down the hand truck frame on rails, and you simply crank it to lift it, or move it down to lower it, or you push the button if you have an electric version of this thing. For this particular device, the promotional video shows that one of the features would let you bring the boxes up to bed height for placement into a pickup. To describe the utility of the engineering of this device would be complicated. You really have to watch the videos on the YouTube channel to see how the device lifts, lowers, tilts, engages, releases, and so on. If you watch it, I think you would be convinced that this thing, it's the real deal. It works. I could see somebody investing in this and not saying this was a mistake. I really think the engineering of this particular device from Hive Lifters is really well thought out. Now, one nit that I could see is using the device for a colony on a hive stand, which of course is a common thing to do in beekeeping, keep your hives on hive stands. Will it have any challenges with your particular setup? And that's something you might have to look into. But again, if you're someone who's not able to lift, and this device gives you an opportunity to solve the gap, then it might be worth your investment. I do think that this would be a worthwhile investment for someone who has a small operation and is moving bees around in their yard. You know, the big guys have boom trucks and forklifts and things like that. But for the small sideliner, this is right up their alley. Case in point, I know a sideliner beekeeper who maintains about 40 colonies in their side yard at home. They're often rotating hives from external yards into the working side yard. And, you know, every day during the beekeeping season presents tasks to move things to and fro. Even just having to take the hives off of a pickup or a trailer in that operation and rolling them over to the staging operation, and or taking things out of staging and loading them up for a ride out to the outyard, would present dozens and dozens of opportunities to use the device to offload some of the hard labor involved in moving all that stuff around. So lifters, FlowHive is in the game, and well, so are some others, and who knows? Now that you've listened to this, maybe Big Brother will share some ideas about other options for you in your social graph. Here's hoping you don't have any creepy encounters. Look for some video links in the show notes for these interesting devices. Roundtable number 3, I call this one Scuffed. Much of our lives, Sharon and I, over the last couple of months have been with our home remodel. And we're at a point where we are painting the exterior doors to the house. I have a makeshift setup in the garage for when we take the doors down to bring them in for refinishing and repainting and to get them prepped so that the color matches the new siding scheme that we had designed for when we did the siding of the house last year. I'm using a spray gun to spray the doors. And when I find myself at the end of a job, I usually have a little extra paint in the gun and had the bright idea the other day of spraying a box with the color of the exterior door. The box in question is a honey super that I got from someone who moved away, and in the course of their move, they gave me and sold me some of their equipment. And this particular box was painted in their paint scheme, which was neon bright colors, and it happened to be this really extreme violet purple color, which matches nothing that I have. As I brought in equipment, Honey Supers from this year, and I did use that box, I purposely set it at the top of the stack with the intent that somewhere between now and spring, I wanted to get the thing painted. So it, by happenstance, presented the perfect opportunity with paint left over in the gun to give it a quick coat of paint, change it in color. That Kevin moment. Over the years of being a beekeeper, I've changed the paint scheme on our hives from white to a nice light gray to Beekeeper's Corner Gold, and now I'm thinking of going with dark blue. When we painted the shed in the backyard, we made it match the dark blue shutters we chose that complement the light gray that we chose for the house. The paint scheme of the exterior of our home is gray, white, and midnight blue. Now currently our garage is brown, but we intend to paint it midnight blue to complement the paint scheme. And it'll match the shutters and the doors and the shed in the backyard. Now thinking ahead, I know that we're going to have leftover paint at some point. We have some from the shed in the backyard. And given I need to paint some equipment, I decided, well, I might as well switch to blue because I'm out of the gold. And I'd have to go buy more, and I know I'm going to have plenty of blue. Also, so somebody else is set up with dark blue hives, and I'll tell you, it really looks nice. I don't know what the bees think of this dark blue color, but, you know, bees are bees. They'll live in whatever they're given. Now, coming back to center, I pulled the box down. I sprayed it with the blue. And after it was finished, it looked magnificent. This was sometime early last week. And yesterday, when I went to move the box and put it up on the stack, I noticed that even the slightest contact, the paint peeled right off. So note to self. And I know paint systems, so I really should have known better. You can't just take a box that is painted and spray a new color on it without etching the surface of the existing paint. If you think about paint as a system, what you want, your requirements, it hardens and it cures, and it's meant to be durable. And most of the time it has a semi-gloss finish. And in some respects, why does it do all those things? Because you don't want stuff to stick to it. And you could wash and wipe it off. And it's hard. It doesn't take scratch and, you know, all that stuff. Think about it. And that includes, as I'm sharing, any new paint that you might spray on it. It's not going to stick to it. Such a stupid thing I did. I know that if you really wanted to do that job properly, reflecting on it in retrospect and not in the moment from last week, you need to break the surface of the paint that you are painting over in order to create the nooks and crannies and micro scratches for the new paint to latch on to. Otherwise, the paint that you paint is sitting over a hard, smooth skin, and it's basically going to slough right off, like I said it did. So now, in my haste of painting that box, I have to go and scrub it off somehow, sand it off, and replace the paint and do it all over again. It's kind of like a fix one, break two situation. So if you find yourself somewhere over the winter doing a little reconditioning of your boxes, know that you should take some sandpaper and sand it to a finish that is dull and that opens the paint to receive new paint. Something that it can latch onto, whatever is painted over. And make sure you get down in the handholds and in all of the places where, you know, they've routed the boxes and all of that, the finger joints. In some respects, and this is an odd thing to consider, sometimes when you break the shiny surface, you get down to the original resins that make up the binder for the paint. Especially if you're sanding it and you create heat, you open those resins up. That also helps the new paint to bind to the surface that you're painting. So sanding not only creates the nooks and crannies, but it makes the binders in the old paint sticky, especially if you get it warm. Now, to say it out loud, after you're done sanding and doing all of that, make sure you wipe off any of the residual dust that comes from sanding the box, because that interferes with connectivity. You want to make sure that the box has a clean finish to adhere to. And in doing so, one of the things we would also recommend is do it with mineral spirits or some sort of thinner, an acetone. That also serves to reactivate the binders, make them sticky, which will help the next coat of paint adhere to it. I'm so smart, and I'm dumb all at the same time. If I only had the foresight to think of all that before I sprayed that box. The good news is I have several more doors to paint, and I'll have an opportunity to correct the situation in the future. Round table number 4, my man. Yeah, Bob Gloss and I, we are buds in beekeeping, and it's been a while since you guys have heard from Bob. I wanted to give an update on this, and I want to do it in a positive light, because I had a conversation with him just yesterday, or Friday. Bob went through some medical procedures recently, and on the outcome, he's had a big struggle just trying to get recovered. It's been a month or so where he's been kind of down and out, and in talking with him, he went through some recent scans and just some updates on the situation he has going on, and I'm happy to report that he sounded, one, a lot better, and two, seems to be turning the corner towards getting that situation that he went through straightened out. It's a rough go when you go through a medical stretch, you're sequestered to home, and you're going through the anxiety of surgeries and medicine and consults and scans and things like that. And yeah, for what it's worth, I guess It happens a lot in everybody's life. So, as a human being, if you have that going on, take care of the people you love and make sure that you look after them and stay in contact with them and such. You know, Bob was kind of funny, and he'll probably yell at me for telling this, but he kind of wanted to keep it on the down low. And then at some point he said to me, "Nobody calls me." He's kind of lonely. So if you happen to know Bob, don't bombard him, but just give him a shout. Say, "Hey, thinking of you. Hope you're doing well." And he's on the road to recovery, and I hope to have him back soon. I had talked to him last week about going over and helping him with some things in his beekeeping operation that he can't get to. And spend a little time with him. I check in on him, and a bunch of our friends have been contacting him. Where it really hurts is that he's not present at some of the beekeeping meetings that we have. And he's one of those people that's always there. And people love to talk to Bob, and he's so smart, just savant smart when it comes to beekeeping. And people consult with him, and he's the mentor to so many people. And so when he's not there, there's a huge vacuum in the world. And so that, I say, if you know those people that come to your club and help people out and just give up their time and do it without any, you know, just give of their heart and soul, appreciate them. You know, Bob is an amazing person to so many different beekeepers. And this summer has been kind of a void because a lot of people count on him to give them counsel and guidance. And he's kind of been down and out. So hopefully he'll be on the mend here for the rest of fall, and come spring we'll get back at it. Was talking to him about the queens we reared this year, and potentially contacting he who shall not be named and doing a queen rearing course come springtime here in this region. So anyway, still chatting with him frequently, and we talk bees when we get to connect, and hopefully I get to see him this week and check in on him, do a couple things for him, and just lift his spirits as he goes through this period of time of recovery. And I'm sure, hoping that his time dealing with all this comes to an end quickly. This is the way it goes. I know other beekeepers who go through stretches of getting knees replaced and all that kind of stuff. It's tough when you have all these challenges and you can't actually do the physical labor that's required for beekeeping. And here's to hoping Bob gets well soon. Roundtable number 5 out and about. You know, there's times when you just get in those periods where you've got so many things going on that you don't go anywhere. For the past 3-4 weeks, I haven't been out of the house. There was one week where the car never left the driveway. It's just the way it goes. Now, this week, I did something unusual. I usually work from home, but I drove to work every morning. And I told the people I work with that this commuting thing is really kind of strange. And it's something I haven't done for over a year. But that being said, when it comes to beekeeping activities, I don't know, it's like fits and spurts, and this is the type of time of year where there's a couple things going on, and it's nice to get out and be with adults and do things. Tuesday is the Bucks County Beekeepers Association meeting. That's been on the schedule for a while. It's circled. They're having a honey event. They're doing honey tasting and honey judging and things like that. I'm going out just to go out, have a blast, go participate. And it's funny because I'm the most antisocial social person. I talk to you all the time in these podcasts. But most of the time I go out just to collaborate with people and hear what's going on and whatever. I'm not unfriendly when I meet people, but there's times when I just want to go out and interact on my own terms. Does that sound strange? I don't know. I'm not trying to be standoffish. I'm just saying, when I go out, I'm a normal Joe, like everybody else. And there are times when people come and talk to me, and that's fine. But I like to just go participate and enjoy whatever's going on and appreciate the work that the people do that, you know, put together meetings and things like that. Such is the case this weekend. I'm going to New York City, the first New York City Beekeeping Conference. It's a citywide conference, BeeCon 2025. I'll be presenting the Gadget Garage. It's a cool event that they set up in the city. It's in Brooklyn. They're going to do a number of talks on various things that will interest city folks. They have breakout sessions, talks on preventing and managing swarms, building native bee habitats, dealing with wasps and hornets in the apiary. And it doesn't matter whether you're a beekeeper, a gardener, or just somebody who wants to spend a day learning about bees. It's kind of a offering something for everyone session. And I think that's kind of cool. It's $20 early registration for the general public. I don't know if that registration's closed or not, given it's coming up this weekend. But they will take walk-ins, $25. If you go to, if you search for BeeCon 2025 Brooklyn on the web, you will find it. It's at St. Thomas Church, Park Slope. Actually, this is the address. nybclub.org/BeeCon. And it is the New York Beekeepers Club putting this on. And what I know about them from my connections is that this is one of the first, and hopefully a long-standing future will be built, meeting of the different New York City bee clubs all coming together in one event. And I love the idea of that. I love the fact that they're collaborating and working together and communicating to both the city and to the beekeepers and creating an event for them. You know, if you live in New York City and you wanted to go to a major event, let's say the North American Honeybee Expo, I don't know, would you go to Tennessee from New York City? It's New York City. They should have an event of this ilk. And here they go. The New York Bee Club is filling the need. I think that's kind of cool. In the upcoming weeks, we have Hive Mind. This is a local one from my bee club. The Northwest New Jersey Beekeepers Association is hosting a meeting at North Hunterdon High School. And I think this is going to be a great session. You know, our club has a lot of history of putting on large meetings for the NJBA and for ourselves. And they decided to have a symposium. The date of this is November 1st, 9 a.m. to 3:30 p.m. The address is North Hunterdon High School, which is Annandale, New Jersey, or close to Clinton, which is most people know because Clinton is an exit off of Interstate 78. And if you take 78 from wherever you're coming from and get off the exit for Flemington, go south, the North Hunterdon High School is but a mile or less or more, thereabouts, is what I'm trying to say, from the Interstate 78 interchange at 31. It's easy to get to from all over the place. James Sidepsky, who we interviewed in the last episode, and I are both presenters, along with several others that are notable and known. And so from that standpoint, you could buy your tickets online. Robin Underwood is presenting. Aaron Evans is presenting. David Westervelt, the U.S. technical consultant for VitaBee, is going to be there. And I think this is going to be a great single-day in-and-out session that includes, if I'm not mistaken, breakfast and lunch. So what's not to love? Beekeepers coming together to learn. I am presenting alternative hives at that session, which is a popular talk that I have, and I'm looking forward to the day. And it seemed like it was far off, and now in the middle of October, it's right around the corner. The website for that is nwnjba.com. Go there and click on the link for the symposium right on the homepage. And order yourself a t-shirt while you're at it. Yeah. What else is going to be there? If you know of other conferences, obviously the NAVI, North American Honeybee Expo, is coming in January. I would love to go to that, but I don't have the budget to do it. So I'm pretty sure I'm going to skip that this year. You know, sometimes in the wintertime, you tend to see seminars and sessions come online. I'm a member of the Sustainable Beekeepers Guild of Michigan, which I think anybody can be a member, and I saw an email from them that they're prepping some stuff for early 2026, and they might have something coming up. That's sbgmi.org. So as the beekeeping season closes down, if you're interested in following up on some educational things and connecting with beekeepers, that's a good one to look at. They are putting stuff on quite frequently, and then they record the videos and keep them in the background for the members. So if you can't get to them during the winter months, you can go back and look at the catalog of stuff that they have and watch them, which is obviously one of the things that I do, because sometimes I can't get into the session as it goes on. They have a YouTube channel and such. It's sbgmi.org. But let me tell you, if you do a little looking out there, there's plenty of educational opportunities to do. And, well, who knows? Maybe you'll come see me in New York City. Come see me in Clinton, New Jersey at the Hive Mind Conference. Or if you want to give me a shout, kevin@bkcorner.org, I'll come out and present for you. I would love to meet more beekeepers and have fun, especially as the winter months close and we're not in our bees. So time for this episode's Local Hive Report. I went into the bees this morning and looked at different things. Now, mind you, this weekend there's a storm brewing off of the New Jersey coast. They're talking about all kinds of flooding on Monday. They're talking about high winds and so on. I don't think it's going to get to our side of the state. I am 6 miles from the Delaware River, 50 miles away from the shore. But we're supposed to have rain and nasty weather. And it so happens that it wasn't supposed to rain much today, but guess what? It rained the entire time I had a moment to go out and do an inspection. A Kevin moment. You know, this is the time of year where I look at all my hives and say, good job, Kevin, but you could have done a better job. I feel that way every fall. Why? Because I start to get those pangs of uncertainty as to whether hives will survive till spring. Now, in my decade, almost two decades worth of beekeeping, I know that bees will survive till spring, but I feel like this year, with the lack of spring forage, that the bees are light. And I did my final one-to-one feeding for some of my hives, and now I'm going to switch to 2-to-1, and I'm a little late on that. And this is what I wanted to say is, my anxiety comes from the moments where I stand in my kitchen, look out the window over at the apiary and think, you should do something with the bees today, but yet everything is overtaken by events, and it seems like August, September timeframes every year are just absurdly busy, more so than other times. And you're also in that period where you think, well, I've got time. And then time runs out, you find yourself in October. I'm not typically a fretter, but this year I think I could have done a better job. And I won't go into all that's been going on, but I don't know. We'll see whether that uncertainty carries all the way through till spring. Whatever happens, we shall carry on come springtime. End of Kevin moment. So I had one major objective today, which was to go back up into the main apiary and look in on a hive that I've neglected. If you recall my procedure this year, I took all capped brood out of a bunch of different hives and I combined it together. When I put it together, I did not give it a queen. I was going to combine it with a queen from a nucleus colony that I had in reserve. But the new colony looked so good that I couldn't bear to split it up. And what I noticed is, through some procrastination of mine, that colony on pad number 6 started to make their own queen. And so I said, you know what, I'm going to let them run the course. I peeked in today to see whether they had a queen or not. And I have to say, before I even put the smoker to the front entrance and popped the lid, if that colony doesn't have a queen, I think I am still not going to do a combine. I think I would rather split that colony up and put a pin in that. I'll come back to it. So what did I find? I found lots of bees. I found minimal resources. They're working on stuff. They have pollen. They have nectar. They have some capped honey. What I didn't find was a queen. And there were so many bees in the box that it would have been difficult in the rain, in the cold, to spend a lot of time looking for her. Now, this is the time of year where I find mixed findings. Sometimes the queen is going to town, still laying. You'll find a couple frames of brood in progress. And other times you'll find scarcity. In this hive, there was no brood in progress. It was too dark. It was too rainy for me to see whether or not there were any eggs in the cells. There were a couple places where there should be brood, but the bees covered all the comb. And because it was cold, I didn't want to chill the brood by holding it out. But I did see one or two small little patches, about the size of a golf ball to a baseball, of emerged brood areas. The only way that got there is if it had a queen. And what I didn't see was haphazard brood somewhere, or drone brood bullets, or any of that stuff. So my thought is, maybe, possibly, shmaybe, could be, potentially, there's a queen in that colony. And I have to wait for a brighter, better, warmer, sunny day. And I'll go back and dig in. And so that colony is a watch. I don't know whether it has a queen. It needs to be fed, as do, I think, all of my colonies, and I'll get to that at the end. Coming back to put a pin in it, I went through all of the colonies, the nucleus boxes, that are 6-frame polystyrene, 6x6, over in the playground apiary. These are the ones that started out as a 3-frame nuke from queens that we reared, and I tried to get them to 12 frames. Along the way, I gave them new foundation in hopes that they would build it out, and I fed them throughout the August-September time frame. I still have feeders on them, and yesterday I gave them all a 1/2 gallon of 1:1. And I have 3 gallons of syrup, 1:1 mixed, and I'm going to give them one more shot of that, and then I'm done. What I tried to do through August-September and now into October is keep them going. And what I found in there is they, unlike the colony I just described, had brood in progress, frames of it, which means they're building bees, which is good. Happy to see that. That's what I wanted. And the other thing that I'm happy to see is that the frames that I gave them, they built them out. Did they do a spectacular job? No, they didn't do an amazing job. It was hit and miss across the 6 different colonies. Some built it out fully and have stores in them, and others, there was one that built one side and the other side was still a wax foundation sheet. I did a little rearranging as I went through the colonies, and I was looking to see, one, did they have brood? Do they have a functioning queen? Two, what kind of stores do they have? Three, do they have pollen in reserve? And four, what did the comb structure look like? In almost all of them, the top box was full. And in my time, I set up two things. I did alternating foundation frames, drawn, undrawn, drawn, undrawn, drawn, undrawn. In those boxes, especially when the undrawn was in the top, they built it out. In the other one, one box, I put all the undrawn frames down in the bottom box, and I had six frames of drawn across the top. They did nothing with the bottom box. That was number six in that stack, the sixth hive on the sixth pad at the playground apiary. So net-net, all of the colonies have bees. All of the colonies have at least 10 frames of drawn comb. Ideally, what I'd love to do is give them drawn comb for everything, but I don't have any drawn comb left. Now, I know it was a bit all over the place, but the short of it is they're all kind of in the same state. They have about 8 to 10 frames of bees. I'm still feeding them. They're making brood. They have minimal reserves, meaning storage of food to overwinter capped honey. And the nectar flow, I think, for fall is done. There's still a little goldenrod out in the margins and some other stuff. But they need to be fed 2-to-1 now to pack it in. Might be a little bit late, but I think I'll have till the end of October, maybe some early November. I don't know. Is winter going to set in early this year? It's hard to say. Last year went all the way through to December before it really got cold. We've seen 30-degree nights, and our first frost has occurred already here by mid-October in this region. Let me talk about the sixth hive. This is the one that the six frames are fully done on the top box, and they have foundation down below. I looked at this box in the past and thought, boy, this box is doing really good during the season. It's absolutely loaded with bees. When I opened it yesterday, I thought, where's all the bees in this box? I don't understand what I'm looking at. I went through the six frames and there was an adequate number of bees. But with the foundation down below that they started on but didn't do in earnest, there wasn't anything going on down there. I went and inspected all the hives, and then I went back to one and started to feed two, three, four. When I got to six and took the roof off, I found all the bees, and I'm telling you, it was like a package up there, in the feeder. They came up through the small little gap in the feeder and were all clustered underneath the roof. Now, this is a polystyrene hive sitting over a polystyrene feeding, sitting over two polystyrene boxes. All the bees were not down in the brood chamber. They were up clustered. And this was middle of the day, 60 degrees. I thought that was the strangest thing. I don't know that I've ever seen that before. You would think that the population of bees would be down on the comb, not up in there. I don't know if the queen came up inside and they all came up with her. It was the weirdest thing. But because I had to feed it, and there were 3 pounds of bees up there, I had to take the bees and put them back down into the brood chamber, and then I filled it with food. And when it's filled with food, the little gap that they can come in to get into that space is closed. So they'll go back down where they belong. That was a really weird finding. I don't think I've, like I said, ever seen that before. Now here's a thought. In the next week, I will find a sunny day and go out in the middle of the sunny day and look at that hive that I started with. And if I find out, I can really dig in, that the thing is queenless, I have a thought. That is an 8-frame polystyrene and it's 8/8, which means it has 16 frames. I broke up all those frames and put them together when I established that colony. Should I break it up and split it over and take it into the nukes that I was just talking about? go in every one of them where they have an undrawn frame, if there are. There's one or two in every one of those colonies. And distribute the drawn frames before I start to feed. What I'd really like to have in those 12-frame nukes is 12 frames. I'm an advocate all the time of every frame really matters in any beehive. 10 frame, 10 over 10. And I could distribute all those bees instead of letting them perish into nukes that I have. I have a handful of nukes that could use more bees. So I don't know. That's what's churning in my brain right now. And I'm hoping that the middle of the week, Wednesday or Thursday, we'll get a warm day where I can spend an hour or so and go out there, do the assessment, and figure out if that's what I want to do. As to the rest of the hives, yesterday was the first time in a long time I was up in the apiary. And there's really not much I want to do when it's in the 50s, raining, cold, and damp. I did peek in on the Waray hive. And again, it just, no matter what, I fed the thing the entire season and it made zero progress. All the bees are still in one box. And what they did, and I don't understand what the premise of this is, on the top bar of the frame that's in the box that they're occupying, they built comb from the bottom up. There's a half moon of comb over top of the frame. They had frames above it that they could have went and built from top down, but they didn't do that. And so they have one single box of bees and two or three little crescent moons over top of those bees where the bees are in the cluster. There's no way this colony is going to make it through to spring. But for me, at least, it's mission accomplished in one aspect. That box had no drawn comb. And I think in the spring, anticipating that they're not going to make it, I could put a swarm in there. And if a swarm gets in there, maybe they'll do the job to build the rest of the frames out in any of the boxes that I give them. The one thing I think about in that colony is I had a box sitting over top of them with a chicken feeder. That's how I was feeding them. And I'm wondering if the setup that I gave them, the space, the free space, was the detriment that they couldn't have the warmth in order to build the wax. But it was hot all summer. It was 80s and 90s. I think they probably could have done a reasonable job temperature-wise to build whatever they had to. And they just didn't have a sufficient pollination or whatever. They didn't have a sufficient population to do it. I had other fish to fry. I had kind of left them on their own. But I really hoped that that colony would figure it out. And they didn't. I think it's akin to like a colony that swarms in the spring and moves into a cavity of a tree. What's the percentage that survives? Not many. And this colony looks like that to me. I did pop the lid on the Apame hive just to see if those bees settled in. Last time I opened them, those girls really came at me. Taking the roof off, I just gave them a little smoke and looked down, and the colony is fully populated and everything looked okay. And I buttoned the roof right back up. I pulled one frame, saw that they had brood, and I put them back. That's the extent of it. I didn't want to start cracking things open in the cold, damp rain, and I left it at that. But on sunny days, when I go and look at the colonies, everything is flying. So there's bees occupying all the boxes, and let's hope when we come to spring it's going to be the same story. I'm usually a glass half full. I think the glass is right in the middle. It could be full or empty. That's where I stand at this point. Local Hive Report, check. Yeah, time for some closing comments. Well, this is the end. I'm out of content for the day, so I'll close with some guidance that I somewhat opened the show with, and it has to do with taking care of your bees for winter. I said I was a little leery about winterization, not because I didn't do a good job this year, but more because I didn't take that fall inventory that I'm accustomed to doing. You know, going into winter in the Mid-Atlantic region where we are, this is the scorecard you should measure up to. You want to have 60 to 80 pounds on your bees of capped honey. You want to have several frames adjacent to the brood nest of pollen. Ideally, you would have 15 frames of bees. Frames where bees cover the face of the frames. I like to see, when I'm counting that, a 2 or even a 3 if I can have it. And what I mean by that is 2 is 2/3 of the face is covered when I look at a face, or 3 is fully covered. Ideally, you would still have some capped brood going on, but that's contingent upon where you are, what they have available, and whether the queen decided to shut down or not. Now, I said before, we don't know what October and November brings us. And ideally, you want to have your plan set up so that if you're going to feed anything, they can cap it and have it done by the end of October or early November. Because you never know if winter's going to set in early. And so on that end, I'm off to feed my bees and make them fat and happy. I might be a little bit late for that. I should have started that a little bit earlier in the year, but I'm still game to give it a run. What you don't want to do is have wet, uncapped sugar solution in the bees going into winter. But this is the thing about winter preparation. Beyond closing the mouse guards and putting insulation on if that's your thing and all those other things, ideally you don't want to have to open the bees for anything. No worrying about feeding and all that stuff, no sugar fondant and crown boards and whatever else people come up with. That's just my belief. If you feed them and put them away fat and happy, you can make it all the way to April, and if the bees are healthy, they'll do just fine with 60 to 80 pounds. That's more than enough to get them through. Now, one of the things I would say to you, if you haven't done it yet, is put 2 inches of foam insulation, the XPS, the green stuff, sometimes it's pink, you can get it at your store, cut it to the shape of your inner cover and put it right over top of the inner cover under the roof, presuming you're running Langstroth hives. That's a must for winter as far as I'm concerned, and I'll go through to make sure that every single hive has its 2 inch of insulation over top. That's what's on my brain right now. Fat and happy. And one thing I noticed, even as the temperature cooled, when I tried to pry off some of the lids, they were propolis down already. The bees maybe know that it's going to come early. Because I'll tell you what, the propolis seals that I checked yesterday and today were pretty stout. And maybe it's because it was on the cool side, and when it's cool, it's hard to break those. But I was kind of surprised how sealed up the tops were, the inner covers and such. When I've seen that in the past, that means an early winter. The bees know. Trust me, the bees know. So the next couple weeks will be a little catch up for me to make sure that I get them fat and happy. And hopefully when I'm out and about, I will use the extra days when I'm not out and about to stay on task, plan the work, and work the plan. Little closing commentary about maintenance of your bees for winter. And with that, I'll say, like our beloved bees, when beekeepers go together, we can accomplish great things. Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll catch you next time on the Beekeeper's Corner podcast.